Now, last week, we began with an introduction to the book of Ruth and some things to keep in mind as we studied it. So I want to very briefly review it. Now, first of all, this small book that contains only 85 verses is very complex. It deals with several foundational and advanced Torah principles. This is as opposed to the more usual concept that this is a book that is entirely about presenting us with a Messiah-type figure in Boaz that is then framed in a love story. And while indeed such a concept is present in the book, that's just really kind of a small part of it. Second of all, the book of Ruth was composed several centuries after the actual happenings that are recorded. Okay. Ruth lived at around the time of the judge Gideon. But the story, at least as we currently have it, was not written, or at least it wasn't finalized, till sometime between the end of King Solomon's reign, which is around 900 BC, and the exile of Judah to Babylon, which is about 600 BC, somewhere in there. Third, the location in our Bibles of the book of Ruth usually varies according to which ancient manuscripts any particular Bible was translated from. If it was from the Greek Septuagint, Ruth usually is found immediately following Judges. If it was taken from the Hebrew Tanakh, then usually Ruth is going to be found following the Song of Solomon. Fourth, Ruth was a Gentile. She was a Gentile that was born in the land of Moab. Her ancestors were Lot and his father, Haran, who was a brother of Abraham. It's significant that this is one of only two books written in the Bible named for Gentiles. The other one is Job. And finally, while there is an extensive list of purposes that this book undoubtedly was meant to address, the chief one in the mind of its God-inspired anonymous human writer was probably to demonstrate the House of David's permanent right to the throne of Israel. And this was in response to the ongoing undercurrent of dissension among the divided tribes of Israel, stemming from a battle between political factions. One believing that the descendants of King Saul, who was the first king of Israel, ought to rule. The other one, that the descendants of King David ought to rule. This had much to do with the civil war and breaking up of Israel shortly after King Solomon's death into two separate kingdoms, usually dubbed the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. We find that the North, at first, preferred Saul's successors. The South preferred David's. So let's read chapter 1 of Ruth. Now, last week, I was a little more preachy than teachy, but it'll be kind of the opposite this week. So I again present you with the caveat that while Ruth will be a fascinating study, it's also going to get technical and detailed at times. So stay alert as we move from the basic math of Holy Scripture to algebra. Ruth, the book of Ruth is page 1057 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. Back in the days when the judges were judging, at a time when there was a famine in the land, A certain man from Bethlehem, went to live in the territory of Moab, he, his wife, and two sons. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And two sons were named Mahlon and Kilion. They were Ephratim from Beit Lechem in Judah. They arrived in the plain of Moab and settled there. Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, she and her two sons. They took wives for themselves from the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, the other was Ruth. They lived there for about 10 years. Then Mahlon and Kilion died, both of them, and the woman was left with neither her two sons nor her husband. So she prepared to return with her daughters-in-law from the plain of Moab, for in the plain of Moab she had heard how Adonai had paid attention to his people by giving them food. She left the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law and took the road leading back to Judah. Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Each of you go back to your mother's house. May Adonai show grace to you, as you did to those who died and to me. May Adonai grant you security in the home of a new husband." And then she kissed them, but they began weeping aloud. And they said to her, "No, we want to return with you to your people." Naomi said, "Go back, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Do I still have sons in my womb who could become your husbands? Go back, my daughters. Go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. Even if I were to say I still have hope, even if I had a husband tonight and bore sons, would you wait for them until they grew up? Would you refuse to marry just for them? No, my daughters. On your behalf, I feel very bitter that the hand of Adonai has gone out against me." And again they wept aloud, and then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth stuck with her. She said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her God. Go back after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Don't press me to leave you and stop following you. For wherever you go, I will go, and wherever you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. May Adonai bring terrible curses on me and worse ones as well, if anything but death separates you and me." When Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. So the two of them went on until they came to Beit Lechem. And when they arrived in Beit Lechem, the whole city was stirred with excitement over them. And the women asked, "Can this be Naomi?" "Don't call me Naomi," which means pleasant, she answered them. "Call me Mara," which means bitter, "because Shaddai has made my life very bitter. I went out full. Adonai has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? Adonai has testified against me. Shaddai has afflicted me." This is how Naomi returned, with Ruth, the woman from Moab, her daughter-in-law accompanying her from the plains of Moab. They arrived in Beit Lechem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Well, the book places the opening of the story of Ruth in space and time in a very general way by saying, when the judges were judging. Now, even in a slightly more specific reference to the dating of it being when there was a famine in the land, that's only marginally helpful for us, really. Now, we've already covered the likelihood that this was during the several year time period of Gideon. Because at that time, the Midianites were always descending like locusts to steal Israel's food supply at harvest times, and so throwing the Hebrews into starvation. But by no means can we say that that's certain. This also begs the question, why didn't the author of Ruth more definitively peg the events to chronology for our benefit? I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like it'd be very difficult to do. It wouldn't take much writing time. The answer is that the Hebrew Bible does not attach very much importance to when something happened unless it was in conjunction with a day of holy observance, such as a festival or a Shabbat. But rather, the concern is always what happened, who was involved, and its effect upon Israel's development as this set-apart nation for Yahweh. That's part of the reason that we have this ongoing and seemingly unsolvable young earth, old earth battle, because the first words of Genesis are ambiguous in setting up the time frame of creation. I mean, the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was unformed and void." Does this mean to inform us that the substance of the heavens and the earth was part of the first day of the 6-day creation process that begins a couple of verses later? Or does it mean that the earth was incompletely formed in the beginning and it just hung there in space, dead and void until some undefined later time when God began a 6-day creative process of sculpting it into a place that could sustain life? There's strong opinions on both sides. I'm not going to debate this issue with you today. The point is, the writer of Genesis, usually credited to be Moses, could have rather easily straightened this whole matter out with but the addition of a handful more words. But he didn't. I mean, why? Why not? Sometimes I wonder if it's just to torment us. All right, cause arguments. No, it's because to the Hebrew mind, the time issue is secondary and unimportant. The point and purpose of the opening words of Genesis was not when, but whom. When the earth came into being was not the issue. It was in the past. That's that. Rather, it was who, or more accurately, which God. Which God brought the earth and its many life systems into being? The question of when really only matters to the more modern mind of rational Greek-style thinkers. That's all of us. Because we want tangible, testable proof of the existence of a creator God in order to validate the legitimacy of our divine texts in describing that creation. The ancient Hebrews didn't need any of those proofs. They fully accepted and understood that the ecosystems and many life forms and existence were supernaturally ordained. So while I'm sure the ambiguity of the first words of Genesis provoked some small amount of curiosity among the ancient Hebrews, that's about as far as it went. Not because they were small-minded, not because they were unintelligent people, but because for them and all the rest of the known world, a creator God was self-evident. And what we call the need for proof and satisfying the scientific model wasn't sought after, so it wasn't addressed. Now, interestingly, the opening statement of the book of Ruth is not only unclear regarding precisely when but also precisely where. It says that this famine was occurring in the Eretz, the land. What land? Well, depends on your point of view. In general, the Eretz is the land of Canaan, later called the land of Israel. It was located on the west bank of the Jordan. But does this mean that the famine engulfed all the land of Canaan from the Sinai Peninsula all the way up to the Lebanon border? No. Again, defining the precise boundaries of the area affected by the famine wasn't really important to this storyline. All we know is that it affected Ruth's life. And so it affected her destiny. No more is needed. If you are of the tribe of Judah, the Eretz, the land, well, that's where you were living. If you were of the tribe of Manasseh, the land, the Eretz, is where you had settled. Apparently, Bethlehem was in the famine-affected region of Canaan. And the lack of food was ongoing. It was serious enough that it caused some families to seek better prospects outside of their own tribal territories. The use of the term Beit Lechem, Bethlehem, of Judah is because there were several Beit Lechems, Bethlehems, in Canaan. And this was because Beit Lechem means house of bread, or more in the sense that it was intended in those days, house of food. Now, a house of food was a granary. A Beit Lechem was a place where there was a grain storage depot. And of course, there were several grain storage facilities scattered around the land of Canaan in the various tribal territories. The one that our story is concerned about is the one that was in the tribal territory of Judah. And it's the same place where Messiah would be born, Bethlehem. Now, one Hebrew family of many who moved to a foreign land to weather the famine was headed by a fellow named Elimelech, meaning my God is king. Elimelech had a wife, Naomi, and had two sons by her, Mahlon and Chilion. He chose Moab for some untold reason as his family's place of refuge and survival. Now, technically, there wasn't a nation of Moab during the time of the judges. It was just an easy and familiar way for the writer to refer to a particular territory on the east side of the Jordan River bordering on the Dead Sea. Moab was conquered and taken over by the tribes of Reuben and Gad even before Joshua led Israel across the Jordan into Canaan, probably around 30 to 40 years before the time of Ruth. So saying Moab was just kind of a holdover. It was a common way of speaking at that time. However, as we found out in our study of Joshua and Judges, while it might seem as we read the scriptures and look at a map that large blocks of land were settled, fully controlled by the various Israelite tribes, in reality, when we look closer at those 12 allotted Israelite territories, they had many pockets of Canaanite settlements just sprinkled all around the Hebrew settlements. And they generally coexisted peacefully. It was the same on the east bank of the Jordan. People who were of Moabite ancestry, like Ruth, continued to live in their own villages, side by side with other villages inhabited by relative newcomers, the Reubenites and the Gadites. But as in the case, as with the whole book of Ruth, even another complexity is added. when we were told in verse 2 that Elimelech's family were Ephrathites of Bethlehem of Judah. What's an Ephrathite? Well, there's a lot of disagreement about this. But as of now, this matter has mostly been resolved. We find a few places in the Old Testament the term Ephrathite. Sometimes it's obviously attached to the people of Ephraim. At other times, it's not. But more and more, it seems that what we have here is probably a very early copyist error or a translation error when the word Ephrathite is connected to Ephraim, and the reason for this is simple. The only difference in spelling between Ephrath and Ephraim is the last letter of the word. We would say a T or an M, all right? And in Hebrew, the last letter is either a Tav or a Mem. They look almost identical when they're written. So it was a common copyist and translation error. So what we don't have here in Ruth is a claim that Elimelech and his family were members of the tribe of Ephraim. They were not. But at the time, we're living in Bethlehem of Judah. Rather, is that Ephrath was an earlier name for Bethlehem. Genesis 35:19. So Rachel, died, and she was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is, Beit Lechem. Okay? But why would the family of Elimelech be called Ephrathites? I mean, how does that distinguish them from others of the Hebrew families living in Bethlehem? To this, there's no certain answer, but likely it is the term Ephrathite was given to a certain clan of Hebrews, likely a clan in the tribe of Judah, that was living there. And it is not a formal name, it's a nickname. Ephrath means something like fruitfulness, or maybe abundance. It was a word that was often applied to a town, sometimes just to a general area, because it was unusually fertile. And it was known for the quality of its produce and how well things grew there. And since Hebrew is a language and a culture that gives names to people that are usually fairly common words that have a definite meaning, like Yeshua, God saves, Elimelech, my God is king, so on, we'll also find women in the Bible who are named Ephrath or some form of that word. And notice the association between Beit Lechem, which means, again, house of food, it's a granary, and Ephrath, meaning fruitful. That the place Elimelech was from was very fruitful and therefore called Ephrath and later called Beit Lechem, which is essentially a large warehouse to store all that fruitfulness. The change in name from Ephrath to Beit Lechem is really more than a simple modification of the nickname of the place that occurred over time. Now, probably the clan of Elimelech was known for their wealth. That was based on farming. So they were given the nickname, the clan of Ephrath, the clan of abundance, and thus they were renowned as the fruitful clan, living in Bethlehem, just as we might look upon a wealthy family in a small town and identify them in that same regard. Now, I took you on this side trip, not only to present you with an interesting bit of information, but also as one of but many evidences of what a very straightforward book the Old Testament actually is, certainly was to people of old, and it demonstrates that if we'll only take the time to understand the ancient Hebrew culture, suddenly the seemingly mysterious or redundant or unintelligible Old Testament statements make all kinds of sense. Well, back in verse 1, we're told that this certain man, Elimelech, took his family to sojourn in Moab. Now, in Hebrew, the word being translated is gur, G-U-R, and it means to go someplace for a while, but not with the intent of making it your new home. I only point this out because the narrative makes it clear that the family was not permanently moving to Moab. Rather, they just wanted to stay there as long as was necessary, then return back home, all right, to Bethlehem. They were not changing their nationality. They were not giving up their allegiance to the tribes of Israel. They were just long-term visitors until the situation at home got better. However, the rabbis have an interesting twist on this, one that we should not so easily dismiss. They asked themselves why, as we find out in the third verse, that this family experienced such devastating losses while in Moab. Because there, Naomi's husband died, as did both of her sons, who had married Moabite Gentile women. And such a horror can only be seen as a curse from God. And I'll add a little bit to that thought later. All three of the family males died early deaths, which was considered an indication of divine judgment. So if it was punishment from Jehovah, what was the sin? Here is the Jewish mindset on that subject. In Genesis Rabbah 28, which is just a Jewish commentary, we read this. Our rabbis taught that it is not permitted to go forth from the land of Israel to a foreign country unless one seah is sold for two seahs. A seah is just a unit of dry measurement that equals about 2 gallons. Meaning in this case that the price for food is twice what it should be, making it all but unaffordable. Rabbi Shimshon said, this is permitted only when one cannot find anything to buy. But when one is able to find something to buy, even if one seah costs a selah, selah is a very hard Hebrew word to define, but as used here, it means an extensive Bible teaching or a profound religious instruction that literally you pay to obtain, and it's expensive. So he says, even under those conditions, one must not depart, meaning from the land. And so said Rabbi Shimon bar Yofai, Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion were among the notables of their generation, and they were leaders of their generation. Why then were they punished? Because they left the land of Israel for a foreign country. There's actually some very good insight here, and it dovetails quite neatly with the scriptures. This is saying that indeed Elimelech's family felt the wrath of God, all the males of the family died, because they left their land too easily. That it was not that there was no food available, nothing to buy, but rather it's only that the Midianites made their lives more difficult by stealing much of their food supply, so making food more scarce, more expensive. It also meant that this well-to-do farming family, the Ephrath, the abundant clan, had the most to lose because their land holdings were large and they lost so much of their crop incomes to those marauders. So rather than stay in the promised land under difficult but not necessarily unbearable conditions, as they should, they just left for an easier life. they belonged in the promised land. Not just any place that suited them. They belonged in the land that God had set aside for them. At the cost, by the way, of millions of Egyptian lives. Thousands of Israelite lives. And the loss of land and life of countless Canaanites. The result, according to the rabbis, God severely punished Elimelech's family. Frankly, I think these rabbis have nailed it. And we're going to shortly see Naomi adopt this same line of thinking. Now, verses 3 and 4 explain that while in Moab, Elimelech, the father of the family, died, and that his two sons had married Moabite women, Ruth and Orpah. But during that decade the family spent in Moab, these two sons also died. We get no cause of death, but it was probably disease or accident, because if their death had been caused at the hands of another, the term would have been killed and not died. And as a matter of clarity, the mention of the 10 years was not how long the Moabite women had been married to Elimelech's sons before they died. Rather, it was the total amount of time the family had sojourned in Moab. But the tragic result of all this was that Naomi, a relatively old woman, now had no husband. And she had no sons, and so she had no means of support. And the rest of the story essentially deals with this very serious problems that this causes for Naomi, and how it would be remedied by the ever faithful Lord God, whom she steadfastly worshiped even in a foreign place where Chemosh was the chief deity. I want to say something to you at this point that might be counterintuitive, but it is also something you need to know before we go any farther, as it will put this story in its proper perspective. Now, while the book is named for Ruth, in reality, the central character is Naomi. Ruth had lost her husband, as had her sister-in-law Orpah, but that can generally be remedied by remarriage. And if the girls were young, and even better, attractive, remarriage was the most likely outcome. Further, it was the custom of the era that young widows would be welcomed back into their father's home, cared for indefinitely, just like when they were young maidens, virgins. So the prospects of a decent life for a young widow were generally good, but for an older woman, one beyond childbearing years, probably beyond the ability to work hard to provide needed labor for the family. To become a widow, to have no sons to care for you, well, that was pretty near a death sentence. At the least, it foretold of a very meager existence of poverty and deprivation. So the book of Ruth is essentially a tale of how a major problem for Naomi was graciously solved by God through Ruth and Boaz. Now, if you'll keep that in mind as we go along, you're going to get the most out of this marvelous little book. Now, some have taught that Elimelech's and Naomi's sons were wrong for taking Moabite wives. And so Elimelech was wrong for allowing it. That's not necessarily so, in my view. There is no commandment of God against this. Okay? Deuteronomy 7:3 forbade marriage to Canaanites, not to Moabites. One argument against my position is that Deuteronomy 23:3 says that no Moabite may enter the congregation of Israel until the 10th generation. which can only mean the 10th generation after Israel has entered the promised land. And it's unlikely that 10 generations had passed by now. Could have, but probably not. However, the Hebrew word for congregation is kahal, and it has a little more nuanced meaning than simply Israelites at large or the general population of Israel. See, kahal usually denotes full citizenship without reservation in Israel. It denotes the ability and the status to serve as a leader or as an elder, to participate in the rituals and the observances, to assemble on holy occasions on the tabernacle grounds, things like that. Resident aliens were not permitted those things. And apparently some foreign women who married into Israel were also excluded, perhaps because they refused to stop worshiping their former gods and worship only Yahweh. In any case, it does not appear that the taking of foreign wives was the issue for these terrible tragedies of the Elimelech family. It was simply the leaving of the Holy Land for a foreign land when it was not at all necessary for their survival. Now, there's been a lot of conjecture over the centuries about the names of the six people so far identified in this story. Naomi plainly means delightful or pleasant. And of course, Elimelech is my God is king. These are both good, standard, recognizable Hebrew or Aramaic names. But it gets a little dicier regarding the names of the two sons and their Moabite wives. Ruth, which is Ruth or Reut in Hebrew, was probably not a Hebrew name. It was Moabite. Now, because Ruth became so highly regarded by the Hebrews, it also became an adopted name used among Israelite females. But the meaning is not entirely certain. Most often it's said to mean friendship. There's no reason really to think otherwise. That's kind of generally not disputed. Fits pretty well with the theme of the story. Now, Orpah, the other daughter-in-law, is often said by Jewish sages to mean stiff-necked or firmness. The idea being she takes a strong position. She can't be swayed. She's not comfortable with change. However, just as we'll see regarding the two sons' names, very probably these were not their real names, but rather epithets that became nicknames for them, because these names identify their roles in this story that is the book of Ruth. Now understand, this does not mean this story is contrived. It's not a fairy tale. It's just a common ancient literary device used especially when stories are meant to be handed down by word of mouth. Now the one son is named Mahlon, which is said to mean weak. The other is Chilion, that is said to mean failing. Now, ask yourself this. Would you name your children? Hey, come here, weak. You, failing, go sit down over there. I mean, this is just all the more evidence that these were descriptions used as names by the writer to achieve a desired effect, to make this a memorable story. These weren't their actual names. He probably didn't even know the given names of very many of the characters, except for Elimelech and Naomi and probably Boaz. So the widow Naomi, who now also has no sons, hears that the famine in her homeland has ended and determines it's time to return. Now it's interesting how her viewpoint is that Yahweh had visited the Eretz, the land, the promised land, and given them lechem, bread. Now remember, this is just a common expression, lechem, all right? that actually just means food in general. What this shows us is that in Naomi's mind, the famine that forced Naomi's family to leave the land was divinely brought about. And thus the ending of the famine was also due to God's intervention. Now, saying that she arose with her daughters-in-law is an expression that simply means to begin a journey. So it was expressly Naomi's initiative to return home to Bethlehem at this time. The two girls, they were just tagging along. So now the story starts to gain speed. Naomi insists that her daughters-in-law go home to their own biological mothers, Moabite mothers. And the wording of the statement's kind of unusual because it's not normal and usual to refer to the family home as the mothers. Rather, it's always the fathers. It is thought that the idea is that they are to go home to be comforted by their mothers. I mean, who better to comfort a daughter than her mother? And it will be temporary until they get new husbands. Now, I can't disagree with that assessment, but I also think there's a simpler solution that plays at least as big a role in this. See, this is a story that revolves around women. It is told from a woman's point of view. It deals with women's issues of that day in a very male-dominated society. And it shows the value of women in the eyes of God and how their value should be regarded in Hebrew society. And it shows the important nurturing aspect of mothers and women in general. So it's appropriate to speak of the mother's home and not the father's in this case. Now, goodness knows that if there is a favorite Bible story of the modern-day Judeo-Christian woman, it has to be Ruth, because it has so many elements of love and romance, coupled with a tender, thoughtful male who rides to the rescue with this woman's best interests at heart. But verse 8 also throws towards us another interesting statement, whereby Naomi blesses these two girls by saying, "May Yehovah deal kindly with you in like manner that they," the daughters-in-law, "dealt with their dead husbands." What does that mean? Well, what it decidedly does not mean is that they have shown respect and kindness to their husbands' memories. We've talked about ancient burial practices and beliefs concerning what happened after death. And even among the Hebrews, ancestor worship still played a major role in their thinking. They thought that someone died, that someone died and went to heaven didn't exist. Rather, it was that the dead existed in some other form under the ground in the place of the dead, and they needed tending. Abraham's bosom and the place of torments were both underground chambers. So it was up to the children or to the wife or some other close family member to bring food to a burial site to sustain the spirit of the dead person, to say prayers on behalf of the deceased, and especially to continue speaking the deceased's name so that it didn't disappear. If a name stopped being spoken, it was thought, It essentially ended the afterlife of that person. Apparently, Ruth and Orpah were diligently doing all the customary things to attend to the dead. In this, they were showing direct kindness to the dead men themselves, their dead husbands. Further, it was going to be important for the two dead husbands that Ruth and Orpah get remarried because they were childless. Because by custom, the essence of the deceased male lived on in his firstborn son. So if he never had sons during his life, his essence had no place to live on. And since these two fathers died childless, it was customary among Hebrews that when these women remarried, the first son born to them would be dedicated in the name of that woman's deceased husband. So the dead man's line would be rescued and it would continue on. The complication here, of course, is that these were Moabite women who, if they did what Naomi admonished them to do, would go home to Moabite families, likely marry Moabite men and live in Moabite territory. So how was all this going to work? And the answer is, we don't know. The concept of levirate marriage, a brother being responsible to marry his deceased brother's wife and then father a child with her, was uniquely Hebrew. But these two dead sons had no brothers to perform levirate marriage with the widows. So now what? You see the dilemma here? But this difficult situation also helps to explain what comes next. When Naomi told her daughters-in-law to depart from her and go home to their mothers and find new husbands, we see a very sad scene where all three women begin to cry and weep loudly, which, by the way, was a typical Middle Eastern reaction. And it's obvious that Naomi was at the center of a great attachment between them. But in this same sentence, a Hebrew word is used that's a powerful one, a word that Gentiles need to get to know a little bit because Holy Scripture uses it often. The word is chesed. Chesed. And in this passage used in verse 8, where it says that Naomi dealt kindly, do chesed with you, as you have done with the dead, Naomi's two sons. Chesed is a lot like the Hebrew word shalom, in that it's not a word that has a direct one or two word translation, because it is speaking of a complex concept rather than merely a word like a simple verb or a noun. Chesed is often translated in our English Bibles as loving kindness. And while that's not incorrect, it's actually much too shallow. It is a word that often means ironclad loyalty, at other times very much like active love. In the Old Testament, it is almost always covenant-related. So chesed implies the mutual and reciprocal rights and duties between parties who are in some kind of a relationship. Chesed is a kind of faithfulness. And it is related in this story as the action and the attitude of these two girls towards their dead husbands And so Naomi prays to Jehovah that because these women have been so faithful to her deceased sons, then God would be faithful to them. Finally, her blessing upon them is that they would eventually have rest in the house of a new husband. The Hebrew word used here for rest is menucha. And menucha more accurately means a place of rest. And it includes in it the nuance of warmth and comfort. Naomi is praying for them to have a husband to comfort them, to provide for them. Now, kissing in the Middle East is generally either a welcome greeting or a goodbye. So when Naomi kissed them, it was less a kiss of affection or comfort as it was her saying goodbye to these daughters-in-law, and knowing it was farewell, they just all broke down in tears. Naomi was doing what was best for these girls. But what about for herself? Her prospects were bleak, to say the least. We'll continue the story next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning, products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.